Welcome everybody to Creating the Futures Board and Community Meeting, September 2020. I am Hilde Gottlieb with Creating the Future, and let's just go around real quick, say who we are and where you're beaming in from, and a little bit about what the weather is like. So I am beaming in from Tucson, Arizona, where we have no idea what the weather is like because the closest fires are 500 miles away and the skies here are still filled with smoke. So, I think it's supposed to be sunny, but we don't really know. It's certainly not as orange as it is in California, but it's not, we haven't seen the sky in a while. So, if anybody thinks that that Mother Nature gives two hoots about state boundaries, no, not true. So, Carl, who are you? Where are you beaming in from? And what's the weather been like?
Hi everyone, I'm Carl Wilding. I'm beaming in from a place called St Albans, which is just outside London in the UK. And the weather here is very unusual, warm and sunny for this time of year. And very clear and blue, and I listen with real sadness and look at some of those pictures from Oregon and California, and crikey, this is real in its now, isn't it?
It's real in its now. It is indeed. Deborah.
Hi, Deborah. She, her, hers. Beaming in from Queens, New York, specifically Jackson Heights, which is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the country. And so weather is, like I said, cloudy-ish, sunny, a very nice time to just walk through the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that yet, but that's my hope. And I'm a guest from the Youth Power Coalition and Sociocracy for All.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. We're so happy you are here. Justin.
I am sitting in Washington, D.C., where it is 76 degrees and it feels like 76 degrees because usually here it's like 80 degrees and feels like 95 in humidity. So we have a non-humidity, nice day.
Hey. Yay. Things to be grateful for. Angie.
Hi, I'm Angie Eikenberry, and I go. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, where actually the weather is great today, too. It was raining all last week. We had a drought before that, so we're going to, celebrate that it's nice, and we've had rain recently.
Two good things. And Vu.
Hey everyone, this is Vu in Seattle right now, where we have a hazy sky and the sun is an angry red grapefruit. And I have not combed my hair. Mondays are a little rough because of the blog coming out and I stay up late writing it. And then I wake up and I look like this and I don't know what's going on. So,
it's okay. And if you hadn't mentioned it, we probably would not have even noticed. So. See, this is the best.
Hey, at least I was gonna say, at least you get a blog out of it, Vu. I just wake up like that and having not accomplished anything.
Exactly. That's where I was going. This is me spending time on my hair. And Dimitri.
I am in Tucson, Arizona, as you are too. So that's pretty awesome. The comment in terms of what Vu just said, I was just sort of flashing that. You know, Zoom has a feature that smooths your face out, takes the wrinkles out. So you might want to...
Maybe you can comb your hair.
Yeah, fine. I don't know about the comb.
Can you put makeup on me before I get on?
Dimitri, there's a moment where you go to turn on the Touch Up My Appearance feature and realize that it's already on.
Uh-oh.
Mental moment for you in confronting your mortality. Yeah.
And for anyone who is watching, if Dimitri and I will be swapping back and forth audio, because while it looks like he's in a very cool loft, he's actually sitting right there. So as we switch back and forth, if that seems clunky, that is so it doesn't reverberate. Welcome to everyone. We are expecting Elizabeth Sadlin to join us at about the half hour. She is coming from another meeting, but did not want to miss us today. And if you are watching and would like to tweet to us, we will be watching the hashtag Creating the Future. And if you are watching this after the meeting is over, please share your comments in the blog post and we will be interacting there as well. So we always start our meetings spending a little bit of time just touching base with each other and sharing what has been alive and exciting and awesome can be good, awesome can be in our lives since we last got together. And I will start this time. I usually don't start, but I will start. Awesome on the bad side is that my laptop died this morning. I am on Dimitri's laptop, and I am in a constant state of prayer that all of my files are there. And so I'm like feverishly, if you see me feverishly scribbling, ooh, that may not have anything to do with what we're talking about today and just something I remembered. So, but the good awesome is that my daughter is arriving on Saturday from LA. Lizzie has not been home. We generally go to LA a lot. We generally go to California, and she hasn't been home for 4 years. And she has been, as so many people have been during this year, she is used to a lot of hubbub at work, like it's constant and there's people around. And now she's working from home with a couple of Zoom calls a day. And now she's alone and alone in a one bedroom apartment and slowly losing her mind over it. And so she's going to come home because if she's working from home, she can work from our home or anywhere with Wi-Fi. And she's going to come home for as long as she wants. Basically, she's going home to pick up her ballot when it gets there in the mail. So that's the time frame, but it's very exciting that we will be together, which is very awesome, and she'll have people around, and it'll either be when her ballot arrives or when she gets sick of us. So both of which are absolutely fine. So yes, that's my awesome. I'm very excited. What else is going on with everybody else? Go, Carl.
Hey, everyone. A big family event in our life is that probably since we last saw you, we've had the exam results here in the UK, which means that my first son is about to disappear off to university this weekend, which is like a sort of a big event in sort of our life. It feels strange. And then whilst we're on events, my wife and I celebrated our 21st wedding anniversary on Friday. So I've been thinking about things other than work the last few weeks, not just work.
Awesome. That's very awesome. So I've got my kid coming, you got your kid going. I like it. Who else? What's been going on in your life that's exciting and...
I'll jump in because I have another. Yeah, congratulations to you, Carl, and also Hilly. That's exciting. My daughter also has been amazing. So I'll say she. So we're stuck at home, as you know, which on one hand just makes me so angry, but on the other hand, we have these moments where we get to celebrate together. So she's decided to cook food each week from different countries. It's part of. So this week we're. We're making food from the Congo, last week from, where was it, Yemen, week before from Serbia. So we've had this exciting, you know, adventures across the world through our cooking, which has been a lot of fun. And hopefully we'll continue even after all of this, when we can leave to go somewhere again.
Wow, that's wonderful. Who else? What's been going on with you?
I'll go.
Good.
So the work I do at the Youth Power Coalition, which is what brought me here most directly, is a nonprofit that was launched in February, so right before COVID-19, and it's about powering youth-led collective impact. So the big thing that's happening in New York City is we have a school reopening plan that really doesn't work for a lot of our youth leaders. And so they, in a week and a half, have planned a school strike for next week, as well as a virtual rally for tomorrow. So it's both really inspiring always to be working with an intergenerational team of people who embrace emergence and believe in collective impact and equity. And at the same time, there's a deep despair sometimes around like, why? Like, why do we, what brought us to this particular point? But that is also inspiration for saying, this is why the work we do matters when it comes to systems, when it comes to structures, when it comes to making the world we want to live in, at least in our own little world. So yeah, I would say that that's a thing that's top of mind. And another is just figuring out work-life balance again. I feel like I've let too many of my personal self-care boundaries go and need to put that back in order, because self-care is radical.
No kidding. Wow. Wow. All of that is awesome. All of that is wonderful. And Vu is going to get his charger because we're about to lose him.
That's pretty exciting about what's going on with possible
I know.
Strike. And there's graduate students in Michigan striking right now at the University of Michigan. I think like we're going to see a lot more. I hope that we see a lot more pushing back on systems like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Justin.
What's been going on here? Well, so, probably one of the more exciting things that has happened is, you know, besides the trucks going behind me that are making it really loud. Sorry.
It's we can't hear it. You might, but we can't hear it.
Okay. That's fine. So, this actually jumps off of something that Vu said at our last, board meeting, and he jumped off as a thought was coalescing in my mind, and this sort of really interesting challenge that we have when values don't match rhetoric, or values in a strategy don't match values in a culture. And so I had one of those aha moments, and I'm not going to go into all of the permeations, but it started to coalesce a lot around me of some stuff of thinking about how I work with people in their organizations when they're struggling with strategy and things working, and sort of being able to unpack where it's actually a values challenge that is going on for folks. So, you know, kind of wonky work related, but it was a, you know, sort of the short of it is it took that, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast, and it mapped out why, where that really happens and why it happens.
Wow. And that so directly relates to what we're going to be talking about today. So I'm hoping some of that will come out. Wonderful. Vu, what's been going on with you that's powerful?
Powerful? I don't know.
Exciting, fun, boring.
Well, I'm doing moderating a webinar next week to talk about wealth hoarding and tax avoidance, which is something we don't talk much about in our sector. And we did a call out for this, and I thought maybe 200 or 300 people would sign up, but we have over like 1,300 people for this webinar next week. So I'm really glad about that. And personally, the kids are, I feel bad, but they need to get out of the house. So we've been enrolling them in like full-time care. And I don't know, there's just no good options for parents right now. But we send them to, and they're happy in their programs. And I get to take a shower and stuff. I mean, I haven't been doing that, but I will eventually. And so that's good. It's nice to take, for everyone to have a break. So we feel very privileged about that right now. And don't take it for granted.
No kidding. Wow. That's huge. You have had your kids with you for months and months and months. Yep, I know. And Dimitri, what is going on in your world?
In the children theme.
Let's swap over so that you can.
In the children theme, that was in the early part of these awesomes. My eldest and his wife officially announced that they're expecting, and this will be the first grandchild from that part of the family, and they're real excited. They know it's a little girl, and that's, yes, I won't even get into that, but in any event, it's just awesome. And part of what makes, you know, one of the things, Angie, you were talking about, one of the benefits of being at home. One of the things that has happened in our family is that we now have started doing these sort of family quarterly reunions on Zoom. So we get to see everyone, and cousins get to talk to cousins who would never really talk to them on any kind of regular basis. So it's just really kind of fun being in there and watching them just live their lives and what they're doing. You know, that my brother's two kids are both homeschooling their small children because of the craziness of whether you go to school or don't go to school, or, you know, they're one day it's on, one day it's off. So they decided they would do that. So awesome is having family connections, even with or maybe because of what COVID makes happen.
Awesome, wonderful, wonderful. And I understand from Dimitri that Amanda, who was with us during our last meeting, will be joining us again. So hopefully she will be diving in here soon. The topic we are continuing to talk about is what our board is going to be looking for as we walk the talk of our values related to racial equity and to equity in general. For those who may be watching and are not familiar with our board has been in a place of figuring out what role it will play within the structure of the organization, and has come to the place where the board's role is to ensure we are walking the talk of our values with integrity. And we have we spent the last meeting and a portion of the meeting prior talking about the equity issue. And what became clear last time in part is that the systems change impact of our mission and the focus of the systems change, that right there is a huge step towards equity, equity in the world, equity globally. And if we are mindful of that and conscious of that, and that is front of mind in the world that we want to create, I will also say that I don't know that that is clearly articulated in our vision. So that's a part of the conversation of, are we being explicit about that in our vision? But that's really what the board wants to be ensuring that we're walking the talk of. And so as we move forward today, the big chunk is going to be looking at our current values and our current vision to say, if we're looking at walking the talk, is this thing, is the talk even there? So how do we want to clearly and explicitly articulate the talk that we want to walk around the issue of equity? So before we get started, I want to welcome Amanda, and it is good to see you. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So glad you're here. If you will change your name from meeting participant, if you can. If you can't, Dimitri will.
Okay.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. And if you want to take a deep breath, we were literally just getting started. So.
Yeah, I got a chance to watch, so that was cool.
Oh, good. Good. Dimitri, it worked. The streaming worked. That alone is wonderful. So I guess, you know, looking at our statement of values, which was written and adopted in 2017, I'm already seeing some things that we would probably want to update. Just to clarify for folks, this is not a statement of our values. This is a statement of our values in action. What do we value, and what does that look like? Because otherwise you've just got honesty, integrity, respect on a plaque in a lobby someplace, and it means absolutely nothing. So the importance of what do our values look like in action is what this document really is trying to articulate. And as I said, it was written and adopted in 2017. And so I guess, you know, probably the place to start is what are our values when it comes to equity? And I'm just going to start with that broad question of what is important to us? What do we want to see? What are we really talking about?
So Hildy, I'll start off to see if I can get some conversation going. I mean, for me, the values probably start off with a recognition that not everyone starts out in the same place. We haven't all had the same opportunity to sort of get where we are. So I don't know if this sounds a bit cheesy, but you know, in that sort of not leaving anyone behind, you know, we have to sort of bring people up, given the opportunities that they might not have had. So this isn't, our values are not about who's the smartest or who's the fastest. This is about sort of trying to bring everyone with us, a bit like a caravan, I guess.
All of us together.
And, you know, the piece for me that is really, I think, a driving force is that, you know, we say in there that we identify and question cultural systems. So just that basic recognition that, you know, the inquiry is not just asking questions, but it's recognition that the inquiry will give us a new perspective that will be different from the one that we have. And so I think, you know, dovetailing on that, asking a lot of the clarifying questions of who cares about this, who will be impacted by this, is this true? You know, those are the elements that really sort of strike me or jump out at me. Sorry, I'm trying to strike from my language because it's brutal. That those components are the ones that really do jump out at me, is that, you know, a question of equity means we need to recognize all those different points so that we can even establish what we are equitifying.
What else? What is important to us?
I think added to that is, I think the essence of this work is sort of questioning the taken for granted systems that are in place, or questioning them and interrogating them to, and possibly and hopefully, and a lot of times changing them.
Yeah, there's a piece there. It was the thing that I was thinking about in terms of our vision and our mission, is being explicit about, you know, the short version of the mission is generally that systems change so that the systems we all encounter are bringing out the best in us. I think that there is room there for being explicit about what we mean by that. What does that look like? Bringing out the best in whom? Or in who? I don't know. what does that really mean?
I guess there's a piece in this that, I mean, it's embedded in there when we say, you know, systems that make people feel stuck. But I think we sort of have an obligation maybe to, you know, we need to highlight that, you know, the issues of, you know, of race that are leveraged to create inequitable systems. I mean, I think that, you know, being really straightforward that, you know, we recognize that there are particular ways in which things have been designed, systems are in place that, you know, certainly disadvantage, you know, people based on race, based on ethnicity, based on identity, and sort of any of those, you know, whether that identity is self-proclaimed or prescribed. I mean, it's sort of both sides of that coin, but we have systems that take advantage of that distinction to create privilege and disadvantage. And I think we may need to be stronger at calling that out, that that's...
Yeah, I think you were saying, you know, create privilege. That to me, what the word that came out of my pen was maintain power. That there's, I am feeling, in terms of my own values and what I'm seeing in creating the future, is there is the malady of the nice. Of nonprofits are always trying to be nice, and in this sector we do a lot of nice, and this ain't something we could be nice about. I think that we can't dance around language. I think that we need to be, there's something about using the words white supremacy, using the words colonialism, using the words capitalism. I have written two pieces recently for other parties where they asked me to take the word capitalism out so that it wouldn't offend some of their business readers. And you know, I could feel the tension in the back of my head going. And I think that just being explicit about what the systems are that are deeply, you know, that meme that we keep seeing, it's not that the system is broken, it is doing exactly what it was intended to do. It's not broken. It's working just fine. And I think that there's a big piece of naming that and being explicit about that.
Just before we came on air, Hildy, I was saying I've been on a bit of a spurt recently in terms of reading books, and one of them that I read was the sort of the Winners Take All book by Anand Giridharadas. And what you just talked about then, he named explicitly in the book about this thing about language and about how people are asked to tone things down. A bit like that expression code switching as well, where people sort of change their behavior and their dress and so on to sort of suit what's around them. And I absolutely get that point about we're nice and we're too nice. And sometimes we think that we're doing good by being nice and we're protecting people. And so for me, it's about, so some of this is about how does what we do create those spaces where we're not just asking the different questions, but where you're creating the spaces where people can have the safe conversations without feeling threatened, but nevertheless still getting to the challenging things that we need to talk about. Could I just then relate that to something back in the values at the beginning, and this thing about being slow, about taking our time, and for me it's the sort of the twin sister of this language issue, which is sometimes one of the things that I'm guilty of is rushing to solutions. Certainly, you mean it's one of the things that I've been told I do, and I need to learn a bit more and sort of try to change. But one of the things that I haven't quite worked out in my head, and I'm going to look at Vu here because I think Vu has sort of written about this stuff, is this challenge of, on the one hand, over-intellectualizing things and taking too long, but on the other hand, using the language that people recognize and understand and coming up with solutions where everyone's had an opportunity to engage.
I want to welcome Elizabeth, and then Vu, you were starting to say something, but I want to say hello and welcome you, and we're glad you're here. We're really just getting started and looking at our values and just articulating what are our values when it comes to equity issues. Some of what we've been talking about is identifying and questioning current cultural systems, naming them, being explicit about them, recognizing where those systems come from, interrogating those systems, and acknowledging that we don't all start from the same place. Asking those for whom questions and really listening and including. And that's where we have been. Vu, you were starting to say some.
Yeah. Oh, hey, everyone. Sorry. This is my Monday morning rambling, incoherent sort of thing, right?
We like that.
You do? Okay, good. Because, I do think we have to think about just using our own process, right, of catalytic thinking in this space as well. Like, what is the kind of future we want to create? Because I feel like so many of us, and we are constantly in this danger of sinking into this quicksand of being very neutral about things right now and not necessarily being relevant to the world that is going on. I mean, right now we have forest fires burning. We have there's the apocalypse outside right now. And I'm not so sure we have time anymore to go slowly or to create space for people who just don't have, who've been given lots of time now to think about things. So I am still arguing with people about defunding the police, even though the movement for Black Lives is like, this is what we need to do. And our sector has responded by saying, well, I don't know. We got to create space for people to have these conversations and stuff. This morning I saw this satirical article. It's like there's a woman looking outside her window and there's like everything is burning and the forest is burning. She's like, well, if only this forest would just protest peacefully, then we might pay attention to it. You know, like, what? But no, you got to be out there disrupting people and burning up people's property. That's not the way to protest climate change. So I think we had to kind of figure out like what is creating the future's role into this, because otherwise I noticed that we just create tools for people to continue to use as a way to intellectualize further. Right? And the only way to stop that is to actually take some hard stances, and that means upsetting people. Like, I would love it if we go out and say, look, we believe in defunding the police. We believe in like ending or mitigating the effects of capitalism. And I think this is kind of where we stand in, because do we want to do that? Because it does in a way kind of shift what we're doing. Whereas I think in the past we've been kind of issues neutral in creating this catalytic thinking framework, right? And I kind of see this in similar to like the trust-based philanthropy folks. And I love trust-based philanthropy, but it's about changing philanthropy to be more trusting of nonprofits. And there were some internal arguments made where one person was just like, well, do we just want to include the progressive funders in trust-based philanthropy? Or do we want to make sure that every funder, conservative or progressives, can be involved in this amazing framework that we're creating? And I was like, look, conservative foundations are already trust-based. That's why they've been so effective at this. If we think about catalytic thinking, conservatives have been very catalytic. They have been. You know, and like right-wingers have been extremely catalytic in their thinking. And so we can continue to be neutral in this, or we actually say, look, these folks who are setting things on fire and letting our environment burn and letting Black people get killed by the police, they are very catalytic. They have been catalytic for such a long time. And now we're at this point where do we want to continue to enable that by being neutral, or do we actually want to start shifting our side, the progressive side, the people who believe in equity and justice and stuff, do we want to get them to also be as effective? In which case, we need to start focusing in elevating this tool and training people to use it effectively. So that's kind of what I'm thinking right now. And I'll stop right there for
right on.
So I think that's actually really important, and it does sort of echo what I was talking about with my awesome, which is we have to lay claim to our underlying values around those issues. I mean, I know that this is a lot of behavioral values, but I think when, you know, if we don't name those, the strategy will get hijacked. I think, you know, that yes, catalytic thinking is agnostic, but creating the future is not. And so I think, again, you know, being able to say that, you know, we do believe in advancing racial justice and racial equity and dismantling the systems that run counter to that, which currently are capitalism and, you know, wealth philanthropy, which are, you know, the police and incarceration models. And I mean, I think that we could, again, be explicit about the systems that we name as having problems. I don't think it says that we are anti-capitalist, but what we can say is we want to apply capitalist, or we want to apply catalytic thinking to re-envision a system that doesn't have the problems that the current capitalistic system has. And that way, I think we're, I mean, I know it's sort of dancing a little bit around that, but it's naming that this system as it exists is broken. Our job is to learn what a system would look like that's better than that. It doesn't mean that it's not that. It just means that it's not that as it is right now.
And one of the, as we are moving forward, just to give all of you some background, Vu has been involved in these conversations, Dimitri has been, and actually Elizabeth's been involved in some of them as well, of what's next for creating the future. You know, we've spent this first several years in proof of concept, and we know that catalytic thinking works. It works consistently. We've been sharing it with the world, demonstrating what works. Okay, that's where we have been. Now it's time to ripple that out so that it does create the change that we know is possible. And what we've been looking at is sort of two threads to that. One thread is to share our education programs as broadly and widely as possible so that people don't have to come to Creating the Future. You're not going to change the world if everybody's got to come to us. If people want to learn catalytic thinking, learn it at a university, learn it at a nonprofit resource center, learn it at wherever, awesome. Learn it at NCVO, and any place that they can. And so that's going to be shifting our education mission rather than we teach, but no, others teach. But the other part of that is actually advocating for systems change. And what we had initially talked about was systems change just within the sector of all of the various systems that the sector uses. And what does evaluation look like if it's actually aligned with the future that we want to see? What does boards and governance and fundraising and resourcing and every aspect of what we just think of as that's the way we do things, what do all of those look like if they're actually aligned with the future that we want to see? The wonderful thing about the way, and we did spend a lot of time trying to figure out what structure would support as much ripple as possible, and looking at a networked platform where anybody can plug in who's doing projects, really looking for the kinds of projects that would advocate for the kinds of systems change we're talking about, not just social sector systems, but these big honking systems. That's pretty exciting. But again, the focus is twofold, is one, the advocacy, and the other is what supports others in their own advocacy. I just wanted to clarify where we have been heading and that this is exciting. What do we think our values will look like on the ground? What would we see teams doing? Yeah, please go.
Okay. Listening to everything, I think what I'd like to add from a potentially external perspective is this question of catalytic thinking to what purpose? So what, and I think that's where I would love that being explicit about what does that future look like? What does it feel like? What does it sound like? What does it look like? What doesn't it look like? And comparing it with the current present. Another part of it is with catalytic thinking, a lot of it starts with interrogation of current systems, right? And emergence. And a sense of, I think a pool of collective intelligence would be really helpful. Like, it took me way too long as an organizer. I started as an educator, moved into the technology world. Now I'm in community organizing, but it took too long for me to really understand, oh, capitalism in and of itself is a terrible structure and it's related to everything else, right? Because time is so bound, it means we don't have time for taking care of our community, for making choices that are good for our environment. And like how all of that interacts is something that could be really valuable. And then a thought on process as product, that's something that I see probably creating the future doing. That's what I see, and that's what brought me here, which is all of those things around how do we create the future now, right, in the space that we are in. So wanted to say I really love that. And then a thought going back to the very beginning of moving at the speed of trust and slow versus fast. I don't actually think moving at the speed of trust is necessarily a question of how quickly, but it's more of a question who to trust. Right? And sometimes we've got to tell like funders and people who are holding on to power, you know, you just have to blanket trust community members. And it's not about you personally building those relationships of trust. It's you letting go of power and learning and being in that space, because people of color, people from who are poor, people, they've been organizing for generations and do know what to do and do have the trust. So just give the resources, step back, listen, learn. It can move as fast as they want it to go.
Beautiful, yes. I'm feverishly scribbling much of what you wrote, much of what you said.
I also would like for us to shatter this notion that change takes time. I know we talk about that a lot, but I think sort of dovetailing off of Deborah, I mean, you know, if the pandemic taught us one thing, if we want to change, we just do it. You know, it's like you want to shut down and quarantine, you just do it. Like there isn't anything that actually, it's our own belief system that makes change slow, there's no physical thing. And I think this gets to Deborah's point, which is there isn't anything that physically slows trust or slows the ability to change. It's our own resistance to it. And I think we have an opportunity to name it now and give examples that can help, you know, undermine that assumption. And I know we kind of get at that about being, you know, and it might not even be, you know, the notion of being slow to go fast, but it's being thorough. And not thorough to the, like, not the paralysis through analysis, but thoroughness in asking the questions, like, have we considered everybody involved before we jump to the next step? Have we built the trust before we jump to the next step? But again, some cases that happens very quickly, other cases it doesn't.
I had a really interesting conversation with a consultant in the past couple of weeks. Since the article came out in Stanford, we're getting a lot of requests from people who want to incorporate it into the way they're working with groups, which is great. And so I've been having lots of conversations with folks, and this person was really reluctant to spend lots of time on all of the, as we call it internally, the for whoms. Who will be impacted by any decision we're about to make? The very, very early questions in catalytic thinking, and I wish I had my computer because I could just click onto the slide, but the very, very early questions in catalytic thinking are obviously, you know, what's the issue that we're dealing with? Doesn't really matter what the issue is, because the very next question is, who will be impacted by whatever we do on this, regardless of whether they are our intended target audience or not? You know, and usually marketing tells you to narrow down, and we go, everybody's going to be impacted. So if we don't talk about that, then this is a recipe for unintended consequences. And this person was just pushing back, saying it will take too long if we, I only have, you know, X number of hours in a session. It will take too long if we name everybody. And you know, I was like, okay, you can either pay for it now or you can pay for it later. Do we want to do work that's effective? And to me, that's one of those going slow things, taking the time to be explicit about whoever the group is that's doing whatever they're doing, who all, and you know, those ripples, whose lives are going to be touched by this immediate thing we do, whose lives will be touched by them, whose lives will be touched by them, if we don't paint that whole landscape. But that's a big piece of taking the time, because we can't be inclusive if we're not taking the time. I mean, little things like we open our meetings to anybody that wants to be there. If we didn't take the time to invite people, to bring them up to speed, to welcome them, well, that's not businesslike. That's, you know, the whole, we start our meetings just by getting down to business. No, we start our meetings by getting to know each other and be with each other. So I think that there's pieces of the go slow that don't have to be really, 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 really slow. But if we miss them, we miss the whole human part of this. And I think being explicit about the humanness is really important now, too.
Okay, round two, rambling. I do agree with Deborah and others who've stated that we should probably figure out what it is, what kind of world we're trying to build, and be very clear about that. And I would imagine it is a world that where there is no white supremacy and toxic masculinity and anti-blackness and racism and things like that, and where the police not murdering black people. I think we need to be explicit about that, just so that, you know, we're not neutral. And then I do think that we have, our sector has this penchant for really creating, removing barriers to make it easier for the status quo to move forward in some ways. Does that make any sense? Like a while ago, I wrote a blog post. I wrote a blog post where it was just like, you know, it was called the flail scale. It was like for funders, there's 65 items for funders to check off, and it's assigned a point about how annoying they are to foundations. And what I discovered was that funders were using this checklist, and they were like, oh yeah, we use your checklist. We start off being like extremely annoying and terrible, and now we're only mildly annoying to nonprofits based on your scale. And I was like, well, that's really great. Thanks for doing that. And then they said, well, but what we discovered was that when we did all these things, it just made it easier for white-led organizations to apply. We still didn't have like communities of color applying. We just made it easier for mainstream white organizations because we removed so many barriers for them, right? So I think we might fall into this danger of when we say things like, oh yeah, like take time to get to know one another and be humanistic in your approach. And like, okay, that's great. But what that does is that it could allow for people to feel like, oh, we are doing this. We're being very humanistic and we're being relationship based, and we're starting with trust and all this stuff. And the reality is that things don't change. People feel really good that they're doing something that is aligned with this tool. And that in some ways allows them to be even more complacent. So I think that we have, again, being very clear, like, no, just because you're doing this, just because you open up your board meetings to everyone in the world and you spend lots of time getting to know one another, That's still not enough, because at the end of it, you're still perpetuating like harmful effects of capitalism and racism and white supremacy. So we got to figure out what those things are, and then, you know, so let's just not clear the way for the status quo in some ways.
How do you all feel about doing that right now? Let's articulating the world we want to see right now. Does that seem like a good next step? Pulling the values from there. Yes, go, Dustin.
Well, before we go there, because I think it is, you know, Vu, in the last call you mentioned, you know, so you sort of fed up of funders like rhetorically saying this but not doing anything. And what deeply resonated was, again, I apologize because it's just so visceral right now, is that, you know, we're not really forcing people to say what are your values and actually claim values that are bad values. I'm going to call them bad values, you know, or things where we value, you know, the status quo over something else. And so we overlay these rhetorical values, but we're still making all of our decisions based on these underlying assumptions and core values. And so there's a part of me that wants, you know, I would love to see, along with what I think Vu was saying around being declarative around the world we want to see, like being very clear that catalytic thinking, like, it really only works when you're willing to do that work at the deep values level. I mean, we talk about what it is that catalytic thinking will naturally reveal what you should value, but what we don't do, I don't think as explicitly, is say, please name what you do value, because we need to actually talk about that. And again, this is coming from me because I'm like in the thick of this with an organization that, like, or not just an organization, it's like, it literally comes up in almost every organization I work with. It's like, as soon as I start asking that question, they're like, don't go there. Like, we can't talk about our values. We can't. And I'm like, but everything you're trying to do is based on this. Everything, every single decision you make is based on your assumptions and your belief, but you won't name them. And if you don't name them, we can't change them. And so I feel like, you know, do we need to do something that's even more declarative around part of this process is requires you to deeply go and unearth underlying assumptions, values, biases that you have so that you can align them against that aspirational set that we want to put in place. I'll stop there. That's just my little high horse.
I am reminded of way, way back when I was still doing consulting. So that's 10 years ago or so. When I was faced with values issues, and I found that using the word values is difficult for people sometimes. My favorite exercise, when it was very clear to me from the start that there was a values disconnect, be more specific, a disconnect between walk and talk, that I would ask a set of questions. The first question was, and again, using catalytic thinking, okay, here's the world you want to see. What conditions need to be in place? What do the people in your community need to know? What do they need to have? Looking at those conditions. And one of those conditions that I was very specific about with values groups that I knew had an issue was, what do people in your community need to value? What do the people in your community need to believe? And it's real easy for people to come up what everybody else should value. So it's real easy for folks to say, oh, those people should, and these people, and they would, and they would, and just listing them all. So that was question number one. What should everybody, what would they need to value in order for this to be real? Question number two was, what will you do to walk that talk? And that was when, Justin, they would go, how are your behaviors going to mirror? Okay, if everybody else needs to value that, that's great. That obviously this is important to you and important to your vision and attaining that vision. What will you do? And I think that those are that two sets of that set of two questions. It could be exactly what we want to do right now to articulate what our values are. You know, what is the world that we want to see? What do we think people out there need to value, and what will we do to walk that talk? By the way, that was always the most fun of my day when I would get to do those. Watching an entire room go, oh shit, this is about us. Does anybody else have any other thoughts before we start articulating the future that we want to see? Okay.
one of the things that, you know, I personally struggle with is identifying the systems, which are really my assumptions, which are really the things I have lived with and don't think about, but just act on or react on. And especially when it comes to the issues that were on the table here, you know, the issues of capitalism, the issues of white supremacy, the issues of male-dominated societies. And how do, you know, what role do I play in that? And do I even know that I'm playing that role? And that's really where, you know, I frequently struggle is, and I think we talked about it last time, is the, you know, how's the water or what is water? You know, we're swimming in this water. I'm swimming in this sea of assumptions that I live in. And I don't even recognize half the time that I'm in that sea. And it is frequently surprising to find myself taking a position, i.e. the system is pushing me in a particular direction, and to find myself suddenly realizing that, wait a minute, what am I doing? Or what am I saying? Or where is this going? And I think that, you know, being able to identify that, different for, you know, the continuum, different for everybody, different point, you know, different histories, different backgrounds. But I think that's really critical and important to be able to do this. You know, what you're suggesting, Justin, to be able to be there, I need to identify where I'm at and what I'm seeing as that's the way it is, or that's the way it's been, or this is natural, to identify those things and how I feel about them, which obviously affects my behavior. So this is a little of my rambling, Boo, here, just in thinking about it, that where are those sort of pivot points or deflection points where I am behaving in a particular way or thinking a particular train of thought that I don't even think, I don't step back to think about it, I just do it. So I just wanted to raise that one of the issues that I think comes up with me, and I think may come up with other folks who want the valued world we're talking about, are just understanding the role we play within it, and to be able to identify that role.
Yeah, thank you. There is that whole practice of awareness. So what is the world we want to see? If we are 100% successful in our work, what does the world look like? And as we look at some expressions that are, I may reframe into positive from negative, just to let you all know that, you know, as we talk about some of the issues, I will be reframing. And so what does it look like?
I always come back to Oxfam's vision, which is so simple, a just world without poverty. You know, and just the, I mean, obviously the without poverty I'm very interested in too, but that just a just world. I guess there's values embedded in what just means, but
I was going to, that was my next question is okay. So let's play with just, you know, I frequently talk about, a world that works for everyone. But again, you know, what does that mean? And what does that look like?
I'm sorry if this is BS, but, the problem with lots of these sorts of statements is that they put human beings at the center. Like we are socially, like we are, sorry, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for here. Like somehow we have a right to be better off or whatever than the planet at large. And maybe just because of what's happening over your neck of the woods at the minute, it's not enough to be socially just if we're trashing the planet. And in fact, you know, one of the arguments that you could make is that as we are trying to build a world where we are eradicating poverty and development is taking place everywhere, that's one of the engines of trashing the planet at the minute. So when I think about the world I want to live in at the minute, I do think about the environment quite a lot and my impact on it, and my values are that I want to ideally try and live a life where I don't leave too deep a footprint.
So a healthy planet.
Yes, it's not enough just for humans to talk about how we should be just to each other and we should lead these fair and so on lives, because living those lives, living just those values that put humans at the center of all of our systems, they disrespect the environment from what I can see. There is a sort of a thing there, by the way, Hildy, and I'm just not nearly clever enough to talk about it, which is, I think that's, we've talked about white supremacy and so on. I think there's very much a Christian, Western religious sort of element to that places human beings at the center in contrast to other faiths.
Yeah. Yeah, human-centric. What else? What does it look like?
Well, racial equality, gender equality. Yeah, equality of humans.
Yeah. Well, and moving into what Carl's talking about, there's something in the word equality that I think needs unpacking. What are we really talking about? What does it look like if there is gender and ability and ethnicity and racial equity, equality? What does that look like?
I don't know how to say it. Well, I don't know how to say this in a more, frame it in a positive way, but
okay.
not treating people as less than or less than human because of their race or their gender or their ability or what have you is part of it, like the essence of that, I guess, I think about. Yeah, like we're each.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all for now.
So the not discounting, maybe honoring, maybe embracing, maybe what does good look like? We're not discounting people for any reason other, you know, any inherent reason. What are we doing?
We're treating them as equal human beings. Or, and then, yeah, I don't know, then and add some, maybe, and other, you know, added to what Carl was saying, that's in healthy coexistence with the environment or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And anyone, doesn't have to be Angie. I'm not drilling on you, honey. Her fellow humans came to mind.
Hey, everyone. I would probably caution us in going too much into the future, because then I think it starts to sound very utopian and, you know, like we live in harmony with nature. Yes, we absolutely do. I mean, I think we believe in that. But right now, maybe we need to move back, like, I don't know, like 20 or 30 years or so, what we can actually have, so we can be more explicit in what we actually mean. Right, because the environment, I mean, it's affecting everyone, but it does disproportionately affect like communities of color, BAME and BIPOC communities, Native communities. So instead of us saying, you know, we live in an existing healthy environment, we should say, you know, an environment that centers like that is healthy and centers the voices of Native and people of color and are not disproportionate, something like that. Instead of saying like we are all equal as human beings, I would rather us say we would lift up the voices of like Black women and Indigenous women and other women of color. I think that might give people to focus a little bit more so we actually get to that ultimate utopian vision, because otherwise people would just skip over those steps right there. I do think we need to be explicit in naming things like white supremacy and capitalism and wealth hoarding and stuff like that, because those are necessary bridges for us to cross. Because if we don't list them, people will just skip right over those things. Delude themselves into thinking that they're achieving these goals.
Right, right. Applying catalytic thinking, we go big to go small. Everything you mentioned is a condition for success. We can't have a healthy planet if we are not raising up the voices of everyone. So all of those are the conditions for success. Naming what good looks like, where are we aiming in the first place? If 100 years from now, 150 years from now, all of the stuff that we are dealing with right now is gone, what does it look like? Then you're absolutely right. The things that people identify with are those conditions. When we are talking about what are we communicating to people, it is those conditions. But one of the things is just the way our brains work. The smaller we start in a conversation, we will get smaller and more granular in the conversation, which is why catalytic thinking pushes us up to the higher, so that we have the room within which to play. So absolutely. And what that's going to come out in, Vu, very specifically, is our values. So if we want a healthy planet, what are we doing to walk that talk? Okay, we're naming this, and we're calling that, and we're identifying that. That will be, you know, our values are going to be our actions. So absolutely, all we've talked about so far today is being explicit about stuff.
When Carl was talking, kind of my sort of take on that is thinking about ecosystems, because they're inclusive of sort of the entirety and all the different pieces. And we can talk about human ecosystems, we can talk about environmental, but we need balanced ecosystems. And I think that, one of the issues that we really have, whether, like Vu was saying, it's wealth hoarding, or it's wealth concentration of capitalism, or it's, extraction of energy, or it's white privilege or white normative thinking. It's like our societies, our world cannot be sustainable if everybody were to achieve what is considered the white norm. I mean, it's just, as much as we want to think about collective enoughness, it's not a sustainable emotionally, physically, environmentally model. So there is something about this balance that we need to be, the notion of sharing, of balancing, of power, of influence, of voice, of decision making, I think is critical to this. And there needs to be an acknowledgement that that does mean that some people will lose wealth, will lose power, will lose privilege. We always skirt around that, because we're like, well, we don't want anyone to think like you're going to be worse off. And I mean, this goes back to what you were saying, Dimitri. Some of us will be. I mean, that is the reality. And if we don't own that as a true fact, like if we don't get balanced in a whole lot of different realms, we can't get there. And I think to Vu's point about sort of the, making it more contemporary is, I think, really identifying where the imbalance is, and that it's not that, a rising tide, floats all boats. No, a rising tide drowns everybody. I mean, it's like, particularly the people who haven't been given swimming lessons. I don't know, we'll go down there. But I do think that that's the hard part in a lot of this, is claiming and truly believing and committing to the fact that there are things we are going to lose. Some of us in the process of others gaining and being able to, and I don't know exactly how to talk about that balance.
Some thoughts in no particular order. Balance. Okay, well, actually, start with vision. So when Youth Power Coalition created our vision, we did keep it universal in that all young people are equipped with the skills, resources, and community supports needed to thrive as happy, healthy, and impactful citizens of the world. But then there's this concept of targeted universalism, where in order to get there, I think Hilda, you mentioned that, it's identifying, wait, who though, designing for the margins, designing for the oppressed, because if we don't design starting there, the whole thing won't work. And so that's why our strategy is to power youth-led collective impact. And Vu, I have a lot to thank to you. I have a lot of gratitude for you for the speech you gave at the Collective Impact Forum years ago. But we define collective impact as community-led, particularly by young people most impacted by inequity, as comprehensive, co-creative, caring, equity-centered, well-capitalized, and courageous. And so there's that difference between vision and then strategy to get there, specifically targeting universalism, and then finding the immediate actions to take. And I think that's where what a lot of y'all were saying about, okay, here's a vision for the future. Here's where it's most broken. And like, here's why if we fix, not fix, but if we build momentum there, the entire knot gets untangled even better, just completely cut. And then a thought around, Justin, you were just saying something about, oh, losing. I think that's a whole mindset shift that's also part of systems change, right? It's right now, people's well-being is measured by comparison with others in very many ways and fear. Like wealth hoarding happens for some people because the consequences of not having that hoard are catastrophic. And so potentially defining thrive as like, hey, these are the universal human needs. And I also want to think a lot about environment as well. But here are the universal needs. Our strategy for making sure everyone is taken care of does not need to be money or money as we currently consist, think of it. It does not need to be power over. It is not like there is a way for everyone to have these needs met. And so it's less, it's losing, it's only losing if we don't accept this other way of thinking around how much more we can gain.
Yeah, the thought that's occurring to me is how much gated communities go away, how much all of the structures that have been built to protect from each other go away if it's, I'm just thinking in my mind, Deborah, about it's not necessarily losing. We've created so many systems to protect us from these things because we think we'll lose. If we stop thinking that we'll lose stuff, how many of those can, yeah, that made no sense except in here, and it made lots of sense in here.
Yeah, and so I think what I'm hearing is, so for example, defunding the police. It's actually not radical. Like the strategy of keeping our community safe through giving a lot of money to professional people who, how do I put it? No, we can take care of one another. And there are all these other interdependent things that come together, which means some neighborhoods are less safe than others. And that's why everything's related, right? Policing, capitalism, racism, white supremacy, all of it. But at the same time, how much better would the world be if community care was available to everyone in a non-punitive, transformative justice way?
What else? There's a big piece in how I'm sort of thinking about it, and this may be getting into the how, but that we would see, I mean, it's sort of everything that you all have been talking about in terms of we would see communities that naturally their go-to isn't, well, we need to call an elected official, their go-to, or we need to call the police, or we need to call somebody else. But their go-to is we have everything we need, that it is a co-creating, and that we would see that everywhere. And that would be the assumption. That would be the assumption of legislators. It would be the assumption of decision makers. Not we're going to make the decision for you, but that those outside decision makers probably wouldn't be needed. I guess is where my brain is going. Is that right now we have systems, we have very hierarchical systems where decisions are made for us and put upon us. And there's something about acknowledging that thriving communities are thriving because they're thriving from inside. They're not thriving because some government entity gave them something, but they're thriving from inside. And there's something about nurturing that. Again, I'm being immensely inarticulate today, but it's just very alive in my head.
Well, I have some colleagues who wrote a nice book called Government Is Us. The idea is that, you know, the government is not something, is not something separate from us. It should be us, right? We should be, there should be opportunities to participate in governance in different ways. And so I guess I'm a little bit worried about setting up these structures of these communities. Yes, I agree. There should be strong, aspects of it where we're doing things together and co-creation that's happening, but not at the expense of let's get rid of government because it's not, that whole thing. So there's got to be, how do we create systems where there are governance structures that are reflective of the communities that they represent, that are engaging communities in planning and talking about and deciding on policies and that sort of thing.
I want to play with a little bit of what we've all been naming and Vu was naming most recently in terms of naming and dismantling capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, white supremacy. What is on the other side of that? Defunding police what will defunding police make possible? And for whom?
Black people not getting shot for walking, jogging, bird watching,
being
going home, laying in your bed, whatever. I mean, all the things. So that's a important part of it. But also those funds could be used in so many other ways, right, to support the community or for helping to create the community we want that's not just about law enforcement and all that goes with it.
What else? If the funds are supporting the community, to do what?
Literally anything. Anything else. I mean, certainly positive things. But, if you look at the state of Arizona, I mean, it's not just, police, but it's also the incarceration. And, our Arizona State Department of Corrections budget is larger than the Arizona State budget for education for all of the colleges and all of the schools. So it's a real liberating resources and making them available for more positive things and not draining the communities of people who of important people.
Yeah, and mass incarceration is gotta be important as defunding the police, or I don't know if they're captured in the same.
Well, I mean, as Deborah was talking, and it is, you know, the response we have right now is to quell things, as opposed, you know, so it's, you know, to quell crime, to, as opposed to prevent it. Like, I think about preventing happens before, quelling happens after, you know, which is it's so reactive. I mean, the system now is so built on how do we react to the problem once it has presented itself, as opposed to an investment that really is mitigating. I mean, that it fosters a different outcome. But, you know, just, you know, what we need are, we need to start with things that mitigate a community becoming a place where there is violence. Because if we can do that, we don't need something to quell violence. We would have, you know, undid it on the front end. And so there's this notion of positive investment rather than defensive investment that we need to make in our communities.
The thought that is occurring to me as y'all are talking is investing in the community we do want rather than in preventing and punishing for what we don't want. And the statistic that you noted, Amanda, about education and incarceration, education is aiming at what we do want. And the incarceration is obviously the opposite of that, but there's something there in terms of that investment.
Is it a line from Victor Hugo about he who opens a school closes a prison? But the point, I've just, for people who can't sort of see it, I've just stuck something in our chat. It was something, Angie, that John Mowen told me about a few years ago, a sociologist called Patrick Sharkey, who basically argues that in a study of US cities, that when you invest in community organizations that are dealing with issues around violence and crime, he thinks that there is a direct causal link between the number of organizations and the decline in the crime rate. So as you invest in those organizations, they sort of, the community regulates itself in terms of how crime is sort of dealt with. So coming back to sort of Justin's point, and maybe this is just a sort of a campaign tactics perspective, but broadly speaking, I would always want to accentuate the positive of what communities can do for themselves, rather than, I mean, in this case, I mean, I recognize that I'm likely to be at odds with colleagues, but rather than sort of emphasizing the sort of the defunding the police, where you're going to find yourself in disagreement with people and your energy is dissipated, instead focused on the positive about what communities can do for themselves. And for me, what I like about that argument is that for me, that my personal struggle with the defund the police argument is that it's an argument against the public realm. However bad that public realm is behaving and getting it wrong, and I just believe in that idea of public goods and sort of coming together, and I'd rather have a positive argument about why the public realm is important and why we should invest in it.
Well, what it sounds like we're really talking about is investing in community building, and you know, it's been interesting to watch the different factions of, maybe it's not factions, but different aspects of some of the things that sort of get patched on to police stuff. I wish I could remember the name of the movie. It was a documentary when there were still movie theaters to go to, that was about a team of cops in a Texas, it might be San Antonio, I could be making that up, that their whole purpose was to relate to people as people on the street. And if any of you know the name of the movie, it had the word Joe in it, I think. Yeah, Amanda?
Yeah, I do know. I went to that movie too. It's Ernie and Joe. And it's available on HBO and was also sponsored and produced by, in Tucson, the Lovell Foundation. And I went to that too, and I recorded the panel discussion and have the recording about that. And it's really troubling for me because, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
But no, go.
Well, it's just so, for me, it's fascinating. We went, we saw, it came to Tucson in January, and I sat on it, and, you know, there were, like, the mental health police, like, the police trainer from Phoenix, the police trainer from Tucson, and I didn't get around to producing those into programs until May, and almost immediately after I produced those two shows about these good police who do this good community policing, the George Floyd event took place, event, murder took place. And and also here in Tucson, you know, we've had this the poster child for the good police. But, and then very shortly after that, it came to light that they had been sitting on a death in custody, another. And so it's just really complicated.
and it gets to where I was going when I got lost in my head. So thank you for finding my head. Was that we patch all of these things onto police. When in fact we could be investing in community where we don't need the police to be intervening in all of the various places that they are, because we just keep patching all of that, all of the positive stuff onto an entity that isn't about positive stuff. And so it even goes counter to the culture within the police department and what you saw in the movie and what we've seen in other settings is when police departments go counter to the culture of police departments, internally they deal with crap. And so I think really what we're talking about here is investing in community building if for no other reason so that you take that away from the cops. That all of these things that they obviously shouldn't be doing, but that we're really talking about investing in community. Other thoughts in terms of what defunding the police will make possible, what ending mass incarceration will make possible. Let's move to there.
Well, so I think building on Carl's point that I think I get what you're saying about, you know, the public realm. I'm also a believer in that, but the police's public realm is highly problematic, right, for a lot of reasons that we could talk about, just like the military. So to Hildy's point, I mean, this actually defunding the police or any mass incarceration could enable us to actually have money for creating more public spaces, more public entities, right? So that are about building up the community, which I would like to see.
There is an assumption. We're hearing a lot about it in the electoral campaign in the U.S. That one of the main functions of government is to protect us. You know, I'm thinking about, Dimitri, you were talking about the water we swim in. We just assume that. From what? From each other. Okay, so that just struck me as we were talking here. We're talking about not just assumptions at the core of police. We're talking about assumptions at the core of what we're expecting from a society, what we're expecting from community, what we're expecting from each other.
Just prior to, well, when you were asking the question, you know, what would be, you know, if we ended a lot of the policing in incarceration and other sort of petty punitive stuff, I mean, more people would be living freely. I mean, just be clearly that, I mean, we're talking millions of people who would be living life freely. That's not happening right now. Whether that is because they are literally imprisoned and can't move freely, or they're trying to navigate through a system that literally will kill them if they misstep. And even if they don't misstep, if someone perceives that they stepped the wrong way. So I guess, you know, to put that in, we have a world where people can live freely. And make mistakes. Can we live somewhere where you can make a mistake that doesn't end the quality of your life? Or end your life. But we need that latitude in our world.
You know, I'm not sure I can exactly state the feeling, but the feeling is that if, you know, first of all, I just have a personal issue with the word defund the police, because I think it's a misnomer that is very easy for opponents of that to latch on from the perspective of fear. But that's not the point that I wanted to make, but I just...
But you did as the first thing.
There's always something in my mind, and I'm trying to figure out, well, how do you say this another way? But it's a release of two things. One, huge resources. So Justin, you were talking about living freedom. Well, you know, Amanda, we were talking about the amount of money spent on prisons. It's an industry. It's an industry that lobbies. It's an industry that does it for the lowest common price, does it. It meaning imprisons people. It's dehumanizing. It has all of these things, but it also creates expectations amongst the police. You know, when they look at somebody, you know, this is, you know, one of the issues that clearly comes up is that, you know, it's the hammer and a nail thing. You know, if everybody's a criminal, then everybody I look at is a criminal. If so, this is how I'm going to behave, which begins to create a ripple emotional effect, a ripple expectation, not only amongst the police, but amongst communities, not all communities, but some communities, and that redirecting those funds toward having, you know, the thing that Ernie and Joe, that was really evident to me, is that all Ernie and Joe were doing is they were acting as social workers. I mean, and they were approaching situations not as police, but as social workers coming into a home where there is a dispute or an argument or someone is having a mental issue or whatnot. And as opposed to approaching it with, you know, here's my two solutions. I arrest and take you in and you go to jail or I potentially put myself at risk, you know, because you're going to hurt me. So therefore, I have to be ready to hurt you back. So I think the shift that would happen is really huge because it's happening not just on the community level, not just on that community, but it's happening on a nation basis. It's happening on a world basis. Imagine if those funds were used to create communities, WPA projects, pave roads, build bridges, do whatever, put people to work, give them a sense of self-worth, of whatever. As opposed to extracting wealth by that process of putting, the way I see it is when someone's in prison, they're sort of like a slave. they are there and they are at the direction and mercy and control of others. And they can be punished more or punished less, but they are still, you talked about. Yeah, so
I'm a formerly incarcerated person. And you know, we so I think go back to what Vu said about centering Black people, centering BIPOC people, and like we might not need to make a WPA to give people a sense of self-worth. We can ask people what their communities want. You know, we don't have to make like an external thing for them to participate in. We can center what they're asking for and see what the communities are interested in having.
So here's a question as we're getting on 20 minutes till we're done. What values are you hearing in what we are talking about here in terms of creating the future? What do we value?
Well, I've heard centering people of color, equality, environmental. I don't know if I'm using sustainability, but you know what I mean. What else is there? Those are some of the key things, like the community engagement in creating your own, articulating your own needs.
Raising of voices.
What's the valuing of all voices? And, you know, I think there's a declaration of affirmative action, which is to say, so, you know, the goal, what we value is that, you know, everyone's voice is heard and able to shape our communities. But what we need is affirmative action to bring forward and give more power to the voices that have been quelled and silenced for so long. And I think that is, you know, people of color, BIPOC populations, and that, you know, I know we so often shy away from notions of affirmative action, but that's, like when I was hearing Vu speak, like that's what I was thinking. Like we have to actively affirm that we're going to do this differently. And yes, we're going to swing the pendulum. that's part of this process.
If it helps, I was working with someone the other day when we were thinking about our strategy and our values and so on. And he introduced me to this idea of even overstatements. So my even over statement for our first value will be, we value equity over equality, even though that means some people will be treated differently by us. The implicit point I'm making there that not everyone has had our chances, and that means we will do the affirmative action that Justin is talking about. And that might piss off some people because they feel that someone's getting more opportunity than others. I think I've heard today that in our values, we, notwithstanding Vu's point about pace and so on, but we do value dialogue and conversation and trying to, I guess, argue about what that good society looks like. So we value that debate, I think, and this is my personal interpretation, I think we value that a little bit more than sort of speed, even though that means that we're not as quick sometimes as Vu rightly says that we should be. So there's a thing of balance there. And then my personal thing that I'll stick back in is that I think we value systems over individuals. Well, when I was thinking about the environment, And then Justin said, well, actually, we've got to think about it as a system. Rather than pitching humans against their environment, we've got to think about humans and the environment as part of the system. And then I think both Deborah and Vu sort of talked about the fact that when we destroy the environment, that comes back and hurts sort of whether it's indigenous people or people of colour more than it does Western white people. So you have to think about that as a system. So I think what I'm trying to say there is that, and I think this fits with creating the future thinking, is that we've got to a point where we have with the environment, because we don't think about our habitat as a system. We just think selfishly about us as individuals. I think when we talk today about people, and we've talked about how, whether it's policing or whatever, and the fact that some people are coming much worse off. Actually, it strikes me one of the stupidest things about the criminal justice system is that we don't think about it as a system, and we don't realize the fact that incarcerating so many people, actually, it's bad for people like me who are nowhere near the system. Because like those people's lives are ruined, and then they come and break an end to my house because they haven't got a stake in society. So that's what, yeah. So we value systems over individuals, even though that probably means that sometimes as individuals, we might not feel that maybe we have the rights that we deserve. Maybe I'm going too far with that.
That's okay. There's a word that is coming up for me and has come up for me throughout our conversation is mutuality. Someone we worked with a long time ago spent time doing mission work someplace, I don't remember where, but he was talking about a village that he was in where the culture of that community was such that if someone did so let's say Joe steals something from Mary. In our very, very narrow view of the world in the Western world, we see if Joe stole something from Mary that Joe is responsible, Joe screwed up, Joe needs to be punished. And what this community held instead was that Joe and Mary are interconnected. They are connected to each other, and that there is a mutuality between them. That Joe is, yes, responsible to make things up to Mary, but Mary is also responsible to accept that from Joe, to work with Joe, so that they are part of something bigger than themselves. There's something, and I'm not suggesting that that's, you know, where we're going, but what it brings to my mind is this sense of mutuality that we take away when we just pick up the phone and call the police on somebody who's randomly walking down the street. I have no sense of my commitment to that fellow human being. All I have is my own whatever, my own fear, my own. So there's something there. And I'm also hearing valuing and honoring, yes, all voices, and especially those impacted by whatever it is, whether it's the environment, whether it is incarceration, whatever the issue is, especially those most impacted, most marginalized, especially those whose voices have been intentionally not heard, intentionally walled off. So while we value and honor all voices and participation, that we especially honor and value those impacted by an issue, those whose voices have been muted, systemically muted. And I think we also talked an awful lot about investing, reinvesting. We're already investing in our communities. We're just investing badly. Completely reinvesting. Rethinking how we invest, I guess, is really what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Re-asking the questions at the heart of that investment. Why are we investing the way we're investing? What are we investing in? if I could hear city councils across the country having that conversation, I'd be a happy girl. I would say Creating the Future is doing our work in terms of systems change, is getting them to change the questions that they're asking during their city council meetings. Instead of, well, if we defund the police, who's going to come to your door? Okay, that's a shitty question. How about, or a counterproductive question. That doesn't lead us to a safe and healthy community where we're all thriving and all taking care of each other. What questions can they be asking that lead us to investing in actual community?
What I heard and translated into my head was I heard community leadership and self-determination. I heard interdependence and that we are all in this together. I heard thriving and health, people and planet. Center people most impacted by oppression. And at this point, I want to make an introduction, which is not just about voices. It's really about seeding power.
Yes.
It's not about listening. It's about following. And then another thought is there's been work on this a lot, especially by Indigenous, Black, people of color, and I'm just kind of curious around transformative justice, mutual aid, building an ecosystem of, transformative justice does exist, mutual aid does exist, and that is a system to follow as well.
Yes, yes. Did you by any chance write those down? If that was off the top of your head, first of all, you're amazing. And if you wrote them down, if you can send them along in somehow, even just in an email, or we will re-listen and type.
I have bullet points. So awesome. I can send that in chat.
That'd be awesome. Thank you.
In this space, I know the, Carl's, the over even comment. We give too much value to intent. We overvalue intent over outcome or impact. I mean, in this case, when we're talking about oppression and power, we literally are talking about impact on people's lives. But I think I think all work around community and life requires that we value impact and outcome over intent. I don't care if the system was intended to do that. I don't care if you're lying that you say it was intended to that when you had another intent. What really matters is actually the end result of what the system does. And I think that goes to Carl's point too, but it's individual too. It's, I'm trying to learn this lesson. I'm trying to teach my kids this lesson, which is, you can never use your intent as an argument to ratify harm that you did to somebody. It's never a justification. You have to own the outcome, we have to recognize the outcome over the intent.
I'm smiling because in our classes, we talk about the negative framing that we are so used to in our language. And I'm not talking about negative things. I'm talking about, we normally will say, instead of remember your lunch, we'll say, don't forget your lunch. That we frame so much of our language in negative ways. And one of my absolute worst gets in my head and I can't get it out is, I didn't mean to hurt you. So you hear this in dramas all the time. You hear this in rom-coms all the time. I didn't mean to hurt you. Well, if you did mean to hurt me, then you're an absolute, I'm in a relationship with somebody. I love that person and they meant to hurt me. Of course you didn't mean to hurt me, but that's the thing that just pops to my mind, Justin, when you're talking about the intention. I didn't, we didn't mean it to be, well, okay, but you did. And there's a piece in that that is about owning that. And in the, I didn't mean to hurt you, what you're actually saying is, I hurt you and I feel like crap about that. But we don't say that. What we say is we defend ourselves and we rationalize and say, I didn't mean to hurt you. And I think that there's a big piece in what you said, Justin, about our owning our stuff when we didn't mean to hurt you. Okay, well, but I did. And I didn't even know it because I'm so steeped in my own privilege that I didn't even know that I hurt you. And I think there's just a big chunk in that.
I take something else from, and you know, we could be here for another 2 hours talking about this, so excuse me, but the stuff that Vu wrote a bit ago, and someone else I think wrote about this as well, about right-wing foundations, and how basically they are ruthless bastards in focusing on outcome. And they're so trained on to the outcome. And we spend all of our time not thinking about the end outcome, but thinking about the process outcome. And we beat each other up all the time, telling ourselves how rubbish we are and we're not doing the process right because it's not inclusive enough and so on. And it's a real philosophical argument that I wish we would have a bit more in our sector, because values are useless if we don't achieve our outcome.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We are 5 minutes from the end. This has been a wonderful start to the conversation, because my guess is we're going to have several more of these conversations around all of the issues that that are coming up, looking at them one by one and asking what does it make possible if we get to the other side of capitalism? What does that look like? We get to the other side of colonialism. What does that look like? And what are the values inherent in that? And what are we going to do to walk our talk of that? If you all took notes, if you'll look back through your notes, take a deep breath, and circle whatever stood out to you in our conversation today. Just a moment of reflection. What is alive for you coming out of the meeting today? What stood out to you in our conversation?
In the spirit of trying to get things going again, that feels like the most difficult conversation we've had for a long time. That felt more stilted and faltering than the conversations we've had for a long time. I don't know if that's because I feel nervous about saying the wrong thing, or because we're talking about difficult things that are quite intangible. You know, we're not talking about an element of management or something like that, about how we deliver X more quickly or better or whatever. Maybe your point at the end, Hildy, about how it's the start of a conversation. Or maybe I should take a completely different message from it, which is we all need to just be a bit more franker with each other and to stop worrying about upsetting each other. I don't know. But just because it was a difficult conversation, I don't think it was a poor use of our time. I just a reflection that felt like one of our more difficult conversations.
Thank you for being part of it. Anyone else? What's standing out to you? You can tell this was a difficult one, Carl, because no one is jumping in to share what stood out to them.
Okay, as no one is saying anything, can I just then offer one other thought? Okay. So when I look at, for example, what Deborah's put down the side around self-determination and community-led leadership, so many of the things that we talk about come back to some quite basic and fundamental principles about how we want to, about how I think we should treat each other as human beings. That we should be kind to each other, that we should look after one another so that no one is left behind, and so on. And so many of the bad things that I think we observe in society is because those basic human traits of kindness, of reciprocity and trust, that they've broken down. And I guess that's my long way of saying, I wonder if we overcomplicate some of this stuff. It's actually quite simple.
Well, we've created systems that are rooted in the opposite of all of that. So, mm-hmm. And we live those. Okay.
I'm still struggling with the intent comment, the idea of intent. And I'm sort of taking that from the meeting today and thinking about it from the perspective of, well, I still need to have intent. So when I say I didn't intend to hurt you, that to me is sort of an after the fact. Before the fact is I intend to love you. I intend, so it is that high potential that I'm aiming toward. It is my intent to do this. And so I'm just sort of balancing in myself. There's intent and then outcome, and then rationalization afterwards saying, I didn't intend to do that, or I didn't intend that outcome, or I didn't do whatever, but you need to have an intent. You need to have a direction. You need to have, you know, sort of where you're going. And I agree with Vu that, you know, we can sit here and spin our wheels and navel gaze for a long time. And I don't mean it in that context, but that we do need to take action at some point, but that's also with intent. So I'm sort of taking away a personal reflection colored with the comments I made early on that I'm not always sure the water I'm swimming in. And I want to be aware of that. And so that's my reflection here today.
I came in late, and I'm sorry for that. I'm always really grateful to be with this group. And since I haven't spoken, I wanted to say a quick thank you. And Carl, thank you so much for naming the challenges that you were feeling, through this conversation. I've been part of a couple of your board meetings, and so I don't necessarily have the feel of each of those dynamics. And I felt frustration myself with that balance of, and I really appreciated the articulation of the valuing of dialogue over speed, which is such an important part of the culture of creating the future. And I also connected that to an experience I have often with white people, in particular having conversations around racial equity and racial justice, is that, and I'll take that as a we, in these groups often externalize, because it gets even harder when we move to the then what the hell am I gonna do? And what are we going to do as an organization? So knowing that these conversations happen over time and will be continue to build on, it is the walking part of the walking the talk that we framed as our purpose for this conversation. Not saying this conversation is 2 hours long, but this conversation in whole, that will be even harder. And it has to build on these, the trust and the ideas, I think, that we're building through the dialogue. But I also note my own frustration with that. So I'm really grateful to be able to, and I've learned tons every time, and I just wanted to share that. Thanks.
It is absolutely in the walking. Yes, I'm and just so grateful you're here. Thank you.
Hi everyone, I have to hop off for a meeting. I do appreciate us, and I appreciate us having this conversation. I know there are things that we need to work out. I know it's on top of our mind that this is a primarily white board, and it's a group of very thoughtful individuals, and I'm glad we're having these conversations, because I don't think we can diversify our board if we don't have these conversations about what we're trying to do and where we stand in this moment of crisis in our world. So I appreciate you all, and I look forward to the next conversation, and I will comb my hair the next.
I hope that doesn't affect like your brain, because I like your brain when your hair is not combed, so maybe just stay like this.
Yeah, don't change for us.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Oh, it's Monday.
Okay. Oh, it's Monday. Dang.
Welcome to sheltering at home.
Other reflections. What is standing out to y'all?
I feel like for myself, like I am just like in the little teeniest bit of understanding the process of creating the change and how the, and asking the questions and setting the vision. Just that whole process. And I feel very, I'm thankful to be here, that I found my way here, and that I've also been invited to be here. And certainly the board needs to have conversations. I mean, and you're having conversations to determine your values. I'm wondering if all of the conversations about uncomfortability and the part that's so uncomfortable to talk about, talking about race and the things that white people perpetuate, if some of those conversations can happen in a space that isn't the board meeting, or so they can get more talked out, so that not that they don't get discussed in the board, but I don't know, just a way of healing. Maybe it's like a little subcommittee or a conversation, or people taking the time and space to have these uncomfortable conversations in a space, to keep doing that work in a space that just isn't this board meeting, so that perhaps your board meeting can, not to not do the work, because the work still needs to happen. And anyhow, that's the thought.
Thank you. Really, really grateful that you're here. Deborah?
Yeah, thanks so much for welcoming me. Thank you for practicing transparency. There's a lot of parallels with creating the future in the Youth Power Coalition. I came this way because we're also like, these bylaws, these default bylaws really don't work. We work by consent, decentralized power, all of these different things. So thank you again for inviting me into the space. Some thoughts I had listening to people's reflections were, when it comes to walking the talk, yes, that's what you use, my particular thought is being very detailed. Like, this is to the extent of language. Like, we use pronouns, and not, we don't ask for preferred pronouns or gender pronouns. We use people with disabilities, or people who are disabled, or disabled people and not differently abled. Like, every single particularly impacted community has specific asks and needs, and that's part of the learning. Or like, we always use image descriptions. So things like that. And then on the part around, I'm really glad that we brought up that this group is very white, because I definitely experienced that and I was wondering about it. But also here, hey, this is a conversation. This is where it needs to start, right? Space needs to be created. And so in the instance where y'all want to have, let's say, another conversation that is not the board meeting, that is very much, hey, we're going to, and I know I'm all in the spirit of transparency. We like keep everything transparent, but we also recognize places where we need privacy. And so if it is an all white group meeting together to say, so you have like less fear of saying something wrong, that's fine. If that was one of the things that you were thinking about, because it can be very traumatizing for people of color, Black people, Indigenous people, to be in conversations around race when like a basic, a baseline of how do I put it, of expertise isn't there. My expertise isn't the right word, but like I, yeah, if you need some, my view is if there are spaces where you need to talk through things a little bit more that's not recorded, that where you won't necessarily feel as much that you're going to make mistakes, where you can bring in external consultants who are have signed up for the work of facilitating these conversations, highly recommended.
Thank you. Thank you. And really, really grateful for you being here. Justin?
Yeah, well, thank you, Deborah. I too appreciate you being here, sharing that voice and perspective. I think I'm walking away with, you know, Vu's call to action, which is I would like us sooner rather than later to put some declarative language down around the systems that we're willing to call out. And, you know, we talk vaguely about people getting unstuck in systems that, that don't bring out the best in people. But I think, yeah. I think we have enough to be able to say, you know, here are some of those systems that we really do think demand people and organizations to apply catalytic thinking to write these systems, to fix them, to make them less oppressive. And I think, you know, again, Deborah, thank you for sort of eliciting some of that language and pulling it out, that I do think we should be stronger in that language. Make it clear that we're not dancing around something to make it okay for you to not be okay with that.
My reflection is I'm just feeling deeply, deeply grateful for having the conversations that we're having, and for what I know the outcome will be. The more explicit we can be, the more direct we can be, the less dancing around we can be, the more impact we will have.
I just want to have a shout out. First of all, thank you, Deborah, for being here. Thank you, Amanda, for being here. And you know, I don't want to, us to have a meeting that ends without my having said that. I also want to do a shout out to Mark Friesen, who in the last half hour has been tweeting away, sort of commenting on and responding to. So sorry, Mark, for not pulling that up until just a few minutes ago when I saw that. The Twitter stream hashtag creating the future. You can sort of see what Mark was contributing and adding to this. And I just want to thank you, Mark, for being here and for supporting creating the future. So thank you.
Yeah, one of our next steps is to have someone whose entire job is to monitor the Twitter stream. Deep gratitude to all of you, and we will see you next time. Thank you all.
Thank you.